After the opening prayer came a discussion of the measures to be considered by the assembly, and the proposals before the meeting were read out. Isn't it astonishing? There were no printed copies distributed. If any copies were handed about, they must have been in manuscript, and each copy must have been liable to errors and deliberate falsification. No questions seem to have been allowed, but private individuals might address the gathering with the permission of the presiding magistrate. The multitude then proceeded to go into enclosures like cattle pens according to their tribes, and each tribe voted upon the measure under consideration. The decision was then taken not by the majority of the citizens, but by the majority of the tribes, and it was announced by the heralds. The popular assembly by centuries, Comitia Centuriata, was very similar in its character, except that instead of 35 tribes there were in the 3rd century BC, 373 centuries, and there was a sacrifice as well as prayer to begin with. The centuries, originally military, like the hundreds of primitive English local government, had long since lost any connection with the number 100. Some contained only a few people, some very many. There were 18 centuries of knights, equites, who were originally men in a position to maintain a horse and serve in the cavalry, though later the Roman knighthood, like knighthood in England, became a vulgar distinction of no military, mental, or moral significance. These equites became a very important class as Rome traded and grew rich. For a time, they were the real moving class in the community. There was as little chivalry left among them at last as there is in the honours list knights of England of today. The senators from about 200 BC were excluded from trade. The equites became, therefore, the great businessmen, negotiatores, and as publicani they farmed the taxes. There were, in addition, 80 centuries of wealthy men worth over 100,000 asses, 22 of men worth over 75,000 asses, and so on. There were 2 centuries each of mechanics and musicians, and the proletarii made up 1 century. The decision in the Comitia Centuriata was by the majority of centuries. Is it any wonder that with the growth of the Roman state and the complication of its business, power shifted back from such a popular assembly to the Senate, which was a comparatively compact body, varying between 300 as a minimum and at the utmost 900 members, to which it was raised by Caesar, men who had to do with affairs and big business, who knew each other more or less and had a tradition of government and policy. The power of nominating and calling up the senators vested in the Republic first with the consuls, and when, sometime after, censors were created and many of the powers of the consuls had been transferred to them, they were also given this power. Appius Claudius, one of the first of the censors to exercise it, enrolled freedmen in the tribes and called sons of freedmen to the Senate. But this was a shocking arrangement to the conservative instincts of the time. The consuls wouldn't recognize his Senate, and the next census, 304 BC, set aside his invitations. His attempt, however, serves to show how far the Senate had progressed from its original condition as a purely patrician body. Like the contemporary British House of Lords, it had become a gathering of big businessmen, energetic politicians, successful adventurers, great landowners, and the like. Its patrician dignity was a picturesque sham, but unlike the British House of Lords, it was unchecked legally by anything but the inefficient popular assembly we've already described, and by the tribunes elected by the plebeian assembly. Its legal control over the consuls and proconsuls wasn't great. It had little executive power, but in its prestige and experience lay its strength and influence. The interests of its members were naturally antagonistic to the interests of the general body of citizens, but for some generations that great mass of ordinary men was impotent to express its dissent from the proceedings of this oligarchy. Direct popular government of a state larger than a city-state had already failed, therefore, in Italy, because, as yet, there was no public education, no press, and no representative system. It had failed through these mere mechanical difficulties before the First Punic War, but its appearance is of enormous interest as the first appearance of a set of problems with which the whole political intelligence of the world wrestles at the present time. The Senate met usually in a Senate house in the Forum, but on special occasions it would be called to meet in this or that temple, and when it had to deal with foreign ambassadors or its own generals who weren't allowed to enter the city while in command of troops, it assembled in the campus martius outside the walls. Third, it's been necessary to deal rather fully with the political structure of the Roman Republic because of its immense importance to this day. The constitution of Carthage need not detain us long. Italy under Rome was a republican country. Carthage was that much older thing, a republican city. She had an empire, as Athens had an empire, of tributary states, which didn't love her, and she had a great and naturally disloyal industrial slave population. In the city there were two elected kings, as Aristotle calls them, the Sufetes, who were really equivalent to the Roman censors. Their Semitic name was the same as that used for the Jewish judges. There was an impotent public assembly and a senate of leading personages, but two committees of this senate, nominally elected, but elected by easily controlled methods, the 104 and the 30, really constituted a close oligarchy of the richest and most influential men. They told as little as they could to their allies and fellow citizens, and consulted them as little as possible. They pursued schemes in which the welfare of Carthage was no doubt subordinated to the advantage of their own group. They were hostile to new men or novel measures, and confident that a sea ascendancy that had lasted two centuries must be in the very nature of things. Fourth, it would be interesting and not altogether idle to speculate what might have happened to mankind if Rome and Carthage could have settled their differences and made a permanent alliance in the Western world. If Alexander the Great had lived, he might have come westward and driven these two powers into such a fusion of interests. But that wouldn't have suited the private schemes and splendours of the Carthaginian oligarchy, and the new Senate of Greater Rome was now growing fond of the taste of plunder, and casting covetous eyes across the Straits of Messina upon the Carthaginian possessions in Sicily. They were covetous, but they were afraid of the Carthaginian sea power. Roman popular patriotism, however, was also jealous and fearful of these Carthaginians, and less inclined to count the cost of a conflict. The alliance Pyrrhus had forced upon Rome and Carthage held good for 11 years, but Rome was ripe for what's called in modern political jargon an offensive-defensive war. The occasion arose in 264 BC. At that time, Sicily wasn't completely in Carthaginian hands. The eastward end was still under the power of the Greek king of Syracuse, Hiero, a successor of that Dionysius, to whom Plato had gone as resident court philosopher. A band of mercenaries, who had been in the service of Syracuse, seized upon Messina in 289 BC and raided the trade of Syracuse so that at last Hiero was forced to take measures to suppress them in 270 BC. Thereupon Carthage, which was also vitally concerned in the suppression of piracy, came to his aid and put in a Carthaginian garrison at Messina. This was an altogether justifiable proceeding. Now that Tyre had been destroyed, the only capable guardian of sea law in the Mediterranean was Carthage, and the suppression of piracy was her task by habit and tradition. The pirates of Messina appealed to Rome, and the accumulating jealousy and fear of Carthage decided the Roman people to help them. An expedition was dispatched to Messina under the consul Appius Claudius, the third Appius Claudius we've had to mention in this history. So began the first of the most wasteful and disastrous series of wars that has ever darkened the history of mankind. But this is how one historian, soaked with the fantastic political ideas of our times, is pleased to write of this evil expedition. The Romans knew they were entering on war with Carthage, but the political instincts of the people were right, for a Carthaginian garrison on the Sicilian Straits would have been a dangerous menace to the peace of Italy. So they protected the peace of Italy from this menace by a war that lasted nearly a quarter of a century. They wrecked their own slowly acquired political morale in the process. The Romans captured Messina and Hiero deserted from the Carthaginians to the Romans. Then for some time the struggle centered upon the town Agrigentum. This the Romans besieged, and a period of trench warfare ensued. Both sides suffered greatly from plague and irregular supplies. The Romans lost 30,000 men, but in the end, in 261 BC, the Carthaginians evacuated the place and retired to their fortified towns on the western coast of the island, of which Lilybaeum was the chief.